My name is Bob Littman. I'm a psychiatrist. I work in Rockville. I'm the medical director of CBH Health, which is a mental health organization. This gathering is a reprise, actually the second meeting of a panel discussion to talk about the stigmatization of mental illness and the discrimination that individuals who suffer with mental illness face in the community. The last panel was held at the Fontina Grill in King Farm in Rockville. Tonight's panel is being held at the Silver Spring Drop-In Center, and we're very pleased that our host, Miriam Yarmolinsky, made it possible for us to hold the panel here today. In brief, and not to repeat what I said before, we're interested not only in focusing on the problem, but also focusing a little bit on the solutions. My own particular wish would be for panelists here to address how we can begin to increase awareness with regard to mental illness, the nature of mental illness, the nature of the disabilities, the people who suffer with mental illnesses, and the discrimination that they may face in the community, so that the goal would be to make talking about emotional problems, psychiatric illness, less of a taboo subject and more of an open, more acceptable topic of conversation, more acceptance in the community, more acceptance in the job arena and the education arena and other areas of society. So I'd like to ask the person sitting next to me to introduce himself, and we'll go around the room.
Hi, I'm Philip. I'm somebody that had my experience when I was younger with the mental illness system and hospitalization, but I had a traumatic brain injury, and I came to this area of the country to see how I could make a difference in understanding how I was treated and how I felt it was wrong, and the stigma is something I learned after I came here, and discrimination about how that affects mental illness, and it's a real issue, how people are treated, and how, I have to say, in an article Dr. Bosick wrote, how other diseases have been accepted, but this is one that is yet to be accepted in the same level of understanding as the other diseases are.
I'm Randy. I'm a person with a mental health disability. I live in this area, Montgomery County. I've been involved in advocacy around mental health and disability for some time. My initial thoughts about the questions you posed about stigmatization, just today, this might be an interesting thing to note. People may know that Oprah has had two shows on bipolar in the last week. Both of these shows had Kate Jameson, is a renowned expert on bipolar, considered as the leading expert. And she's a psychologist, and she's affiliated with Johns Hopkins. So I have been for some time trying to think about how to reach, get a hold of her, to talk to her personally. And I happened to call Hopkins today, because it's almost impossible to find anything out on her website. And I talked to two people today, and one person who works with her in a psychiatry team department told me that they've been getting flooded with calls at the psychiatry department since the show, and she said that the first show, which was a week ago on bipolar, had so much response that that's why they decided, the show kind of decided to do another one. I mean, it's very rare they do a follow up that quickly, and she was on both shows, and they had so much response. So I think that told us something. Phenomenal that Oprah's doing this stuff, because you can reach people who never would have known this. But then I find it, of all things, that Kay Jameson doesn't actually have a website. So one thing I'm going to work on to do my little piece to help, this little piece to help promote awareness, is to get in touch with her to get her website going, because you can put her clips from Oprah on it. One other thought I had just for now, though, is I think that certainly there's a lot of stigmatization and discrimination. Some of us remember a couple years ago there was a horrible City Paper article about mental health, and he used a very derogatory language in the City Paper. There was some personal connection. The writer was like a girlfriend or something of the editor, and there was some of this stuff. There was a protest about this, and she never, they never met with us, they never apologized. There's that, but then there's also, I think there's a stigmatization that, in a sense, we sort of bring on ourselves, and I mean we, meaning that there's a, you know, people involved in mental health and mental health consumer movements. And without getting into the details now, but I think that there's something in the area of, in trying to avoid stigma, I think we also obfuscate reality to a large extent. So, for example, I don't use the word consumer on purpose. I purposely use the word, I'm a person with a mental health disability. Because even in the language we use, we have a public mental health system. We don't have a developmental disability system. I'm a person with a disability. There's nothing to be ashamed about. And by definition, under federal law, I meet the definitions of a person with disability. So I think, in a way, we're sometimes our own worst enemy, because in our effort to avoid stigma, we actually create the conditions which lead to things like lack of services, lack of a well-funded system, lack of a system, period, actually. So that's my initial thoughts.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm Miriam. I have a son who I had to advocate for many years. I guess the way he was stigmatized is by being at school and being different. And he actually was not diagnosed with a mental illness, or it's a spectrum of disorders that we don't know what to, you know, what name to use for. At this point, he's stuck in Montgomery College. He got, even though he never went to school, he got his GED, and he's studying. But I am wondering, you know, what it is going to be for him, what kind of life it is going to be for him if he keeps on just going to school and not ever talk to anybody. And here I want to raise the question of the outreach. How do we, you know, how do we not turn our back to somebody who is a little bit different and might not be at first sight very open and very willing to talk to you? And because of this, the problem with the late problem with the, you know, the last few problems with the college students, not that I'm really worried about my son in particular, but I think he fits exactly in this kind of profile, and so, and I'm, you know, I'm worried for about college students in general.
I'm Larry Abramson. I'm the vocational director at St. Luke's House, and we're a private nonprofit rehabilitation and mental health organization located in Bethesda and Silver Spring. First off, I'm happy to be here. It's great to be around so many people with such an important topic, especially people that are a recipient of services. It's a great, great opportunity. That I think that I've talked to Pete and Randy about this event, the last event. I'm sorry I couldn't make the first one. It's interesting, you always hear what you want to hear in a subject. And for me, services to students transitioning from school to work or further education is a key point. And when I think of the event at Virginia Tech, what I think about is our career transition program and how that program could have helped that young man in his transition from high school to college, and that many times the children's mental health system, which he was a part of, and the adult mental health system, whether it be on a college campus or in a local community, don't do a very good job of talking to each other. And the school side is, that you're entitled to services if you have a special education or a 504 plan, but on the adult side, it's an eligibility driven, and that you have to apply for it, and nobody checks on you. If you're a no-show, they cancel the appointment, cancel the authorization, whatever. So our program supports students first in establishing the transition goals, helping them get a paid job, and helping them in their transition post high school. We serve 50 students a year. We've been doing that since 1993, and with very high outcomes, 80 to 90% employed every year, and that we serve 50 new students a year. So we've served since 93, if you do the math, that's, you know, 700 students. And we have the potential of serving many, many more students through a national project with the Social Security Administration, and we'll find out in the next year or so. In terms of our fight against stigma, that it's multi-layered. Clearly, as a employment person, I think that employment is one of the greatest ways to help reduce stigma. You know, people with disabilities meet many people without disabilities. They're seen as employees first, and they see that their coworkers have lots of problems too, and people just working together. My staff are out talking to employers every day. To say that there's not stigma would be ridiculous. But I would say that many employers are very interested in hiring people with disabilities. It helps that we have a good labor market here, and so what they're concerned about most is, can the person do the job? And that after that, they're certainly open to making reasonable accommodations to help them be successful in the job. So I think that using the events of Virginia Tech to discuss stigma is great, and in every crisis there's an opportunity. So I'm happy to hear about that. I guess the one other fact I can tell you is that there are close to 2,000 high school students that have an O6 label, have an emotional disturbance where their mental health affects their employment in Montgomery County.
High school students.
Yeah. So there's many more if you do the full range, and they get a variety of level of services. And Fairfax County and Montgomery County does as good a job as any place in the country in helping to support their special education students. But there's many more. The service needs are much greater than the services that are out there. And especially for people with mental health issues, that the stigma associated with getting those services is pretty hard. And that one of the things that we use in our career transition program is that we use the carrot of employment, or the carrot of helping them get a job or move out, as for them to come and accept the services. And then many times we backdoor the mental health services, promoting education, promoting disability awareness. If the standard high school senior or high school junior that's experiencing mental health problems, chances are they're not going to be raising their hand and say, gee, I really wish to see a therapist, or gee, I wish I could get on some medication to help me function better in the community. So I think that having the carrots out there for them. And probably the last thing, and then I'll move on, is, you know, these students, they're teenagers first. Even if they have schizophrenia or manic depression or major depression, when they think of themselves, their first thought of themselves is, you know, I'm a teenager. And that you know, if we can continue to help them have that perception and help them get integrated into the community, rather than seeing themselves as mental health patients, that's going to help them in the future.
True of adults too.
But certainly.
We're people first, citizens first.
Right. I mean, the issue is that you got them at a time when you can help promote change quickly. Things happen fast in a teenager's life.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Regina Parfit, and I'm diagnosed schizoaffective. I have been a mental health consumer for many years. I have firsthand experience of the stigma. Being marked with a disease for someone struggling with it creates, first of all, isolation what happens with the stigma and then in communities where information is not out about the illness and the resources that are available, the help that's available to help the affected person to be able to cope with the illness and deal with it. It's a very serious issue. For me, it took a number of years of just finding that there is help out there. There's resources, that there is a professional help to help you cope with your daily day function, your everyday living. I think as the community, the professional mental health communities are going to try to educate people and to open up opportunities for work, for jobs, and that's helped me tremendously with my illness to work at jobs. I've had jobs where the employer was not aware of my mental illness and expected my performance to be great, and there were days where I was maybe having symptoms and wasn't up to par. And then I had jobs where the employees were aware, and the treatment is a little different when they are aware as opposed to when they are not. Employers who are aware tend to be a bit more understanding and accommodating when you have those days where you need time off or you're having symptoms. And so if the more employers are aware, it helps the job transition. And so I've been blessed that way. Stigma in your own environment, your own family, can be difficult too. Family members not aware of the disease and the functions of the brain and how that affects your normal everyday function affects family members. And so education is very, very, very important with family members. And for me, having to discuss it can be tense. My parents and my mom dealt with me since I was a young person with a psychiatrist in the community. And she did the best she could, but she didn't have the education to quite understand all the ramifications of the sickness. And so it takes someone affected with the disease to also educate ourselves that we can help family members. But the stigma is very debilitating in itself because the general population are just not aware of the sickness. And so I'm glad to be part of this panel to learn some more myself, to educate myself even more, and become a part of the community. Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome, Regina. Welcome, everyone. And thank you for gathering here. My name is Miriam Yarmolinsky. I'm director of Silver Spring Drop-In Center, a consumer, quote-unquote, peer-run support and education and advocacy program, which is part of affiliated Sante Group, a private nonprofit mental health agency. I'm going to be pretty brief in this introduction, and then I'll probably pick it up when we're done with the intros. I'm a person also with psychiatric disabilities, and I have found, strangely enough, that in this particular line of work in the last 3 or 4 years, I've been open to the public about having these kinds of illnesses. And in doing advocacy work and running a program, first starting out as volunteering and being on lots of boards and different little events, kind of gave me a lot of confidence. And actually, in the day-to-day working with other folks with mental health concerns, and helping in whatever way, whether it's pointing to other resources, because we partner with all the neighboring organizations, including all of the groups represented here, or just being an ear, or even recounting some of my really bad days. I feel like this is like an amazingly powerful and what's the word? Therapeutic thing. So I'm not driven by my symptoms. I feel a lot less ill than I ever probably have, which is good, but I can't count on it. Like most of us with chronic illnesses can't necessarily count on it. So while things are good, it's good to take steps to prevent, you know, relapses, as they say. And we do that in our programming with NAMI. We have NAMI peer-to-peer 10-week recovery education courses, and NAMI support groups and family support groups. A lot of our members are, you know, also family members. You know, we fit all sorts of different groups, and some of us are also providers as well as receivers of services. There is one thing about stigma that sometimes it is even, it's probably a lot of it is internal, and if you're out as a person with an illness, you might have to, or I do sometimes, you feel like you have to perform extra well. You can't have little meltdowns, which I do anyway, but you know, you feel like you have to do work twice as hard or three times as hard as other people. And I've been guilty of that, and then other times I'll kind of flip to the other way and like, hey, you know, everyone knows I'm a consumer, so, you know, I can slack off a little. It's a very strange dynamic to flip back and forth. But anyway, I'm just glad to be part of this discussion, and I'll bring up some ideas, but I just wanted to introduce myself first. Thanks.
Thank you. My name is Dr. August Spector, and right now I am retired and do consulting work and counseling with people with what I call the unseen disabilities, primarily attention deficit disorders, as well as other forms of mental issues that people have. Prior to retiring, I was the manager of an agency, federal government agency's disability health and disability and safety program. So and currently I'm also on the advisory board of the drop-in center here in Silver Spring that Miriam just talked about. So I'm coming from this from several points of view. One is as a person who's kind of an advocate, a person who's been involved with developing policies and trying to educate people in the workplace and dealing with workplace issues, as well as dealing with people like people who come to the drop-in center. And so I've seen all the different angles. And what I see is a little different than what has already been said. That is, I think there's a terrible issue of stigma. I agree with that. I see some hope. And I think that's always nice to have some hope. What I see is a greater awareness of these issues. Stigma, bullying in the workplace. There is a greater awareness of the types of accommodations which are available. Since the ADA, Americans with Disabilities Act in 1990 was passed, and since various student programs where they get federal government aid or state aid for accommodations in schools, children are being brought up today, many of them, with a better understanding of disabilities, unseen disabilities in this case, mental disabilities. And they also understand, for example, when a child goes to college, they are entitled to an accommodation. Every school in the United States which receives federal grant money, and I think almost every one of them does, even many religious institutions also receive grant money from the state and federal government, they are required to provide accommodations for students who have unseen disabilities, as Larry indicated a little earlier. I think it's Larry, right? And these students have received this kind of help while they were in public school, with 504 plans, etc. Now they get into college, and they expect to have some accommodations. And if they're smart enough to apply for these things, they get the accommodation. Now they graduate from college. When they graduate from college, just prior to that, many students receive employment counseling at the colleges. And they are told, and they're aware of the fact that an employer can give a person a reasonable accommodation. It's interesting to look at the definition of a reasonable accommodation, but the point is they're entitled to this. Now, the employer, on the other hand, especially ones who are older, let's say in their 40s and 50s, like myself in the 60s, okay, they might not be aware of this. The managers might not be aware. So they form a stigma. Yet the younger managers, and this is where I see some hope, the younger managers who have been through this, some of them have mental issues themselves and have gone through these various programs. So they will have, I think, in the future, and I am beginning to see it in the workplace, that they will have in the future a little more understanding and some more desire and ability to give an accommodation to some of these people that are coming through. The employees are aware of this. They have to make the employer aware of this, and the employer has to come up with a way of educating their managers, etc., which we can discuss later on. Some programs I did with the government, we could discuss some of that. So I see the issue of stigma and bullying together, and there's a lot of research and articles in the magazines, etc., about bullying and stigma. Television program that Randy discussed, I watched that also, the Oprah shows at 4 or 5 o'clock in the evening, the last couple of days. And the whole idea of the law giving people an ability to use the law on both sides, and the fact that students are getting more aware, the public is becoming more aware of these kinds of problems. So one thing I think we could look at some hope rather than just looking at the negative. And I'll stop there and we'll continue later.
Okay. Thank you. My name's Daryl Wagner. I'll be brief. I have two reasons for being here. One is that I've been a consumer for a number of years. This time last year I was in the hospital. I have issues of depression, which is probably my main issue, some psychosis and attention deficit disorder. Seems like I've spent more of my life looking for a job than I have been working. But I did, on the positive side, the second reason I'm here is that I finished a social work degree a couple of years ago, and took me about 8 years to get through, but I finished the degree. So I'm here. I have a professional interest in mental illness, and I'm actually in the process, since last year, being in the hospital last year, I'm actually in the process of getting back into the professional world, and I'm actually going through a slow, careful process of going through St. Luke's, if possible. I'm applying for Medicaid to try to use the St. Luke's program to get back into the full-time work world. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good luck.
I think we have one more first.
My name is Scott Silty. I am a consumer diagnosed with bipolar manic depression with psychotic features. I've had the illness since my late teens, but I wasn't diagnosed until about 20 years ago. As far as stigma, I've seen a lot of stigma in jobs that I've had. I had a job when I came to Maryland where, when I was going through a recovery program, they recommended that I tell my employer the condition that I had, and which I did. I completely leveled, and then I would come in to work and there'd be like cartoons up in the bulletin board of a bipolar bear, and people would whisper my name like it was a psychosis, you know. And I laughed at it. I tried to laugh at all that, but after a while it kind of got to be, I'm trying to explain the feelings. It was sad because it would bring up some very painful moments that I had in my life. Eventually, I was having a medical condition with that. Eventually, I was let go from that job. I was brought in and terminated. And I can tell you that to try to go after and find a legal remedy for that, there's really nobody that wants to do it. There's no pro bono attorneys out there that want to do that. And the EEOC has limitations set on the size of a company. So unless it's a big company, over, I think, like 24 employees or 19 employees, something like that, you're basically screwed. So you can't do anything. So you're better off focusing on to try to get another job and put that horrible discrimination behind you. And when you've been discriminated against, whether it be racially, sexually, whatever the reason, it's a very that stigma, and it caused me to really question myself and affect my self-esteem, which helps, you know, keeps you from getting back up on the horse and forget that you need to get back up on the horse and start riding again, especially when you have a mental illness, because it can even trigger a relapse or bring on a deeper depression or anxiety related to that mental illness. So you kind of get I don't know what it's like to be discriminated for other reasons, or that this was the most impact that I've ever felt was from my mental illness. I mean, I've had it for other reasons, but so I can't say that it's the worst thing, but it was pretty bad. And I've had it several times. So then my psychiatrist at the time said, you know, that his recommendation was to never tell your employer. And that was kind of the advice that I think I've followed pretty much since. But I think I was past president of the Mental Health Association of Prince George's County. And I remember in 2000, there was a presidential commission on mental health. And they determined that that report determined that the biggest impact on people with mental health was stigma. And I don't know if any of you have had a chance to read that report. It's available, you can go online and read it, but it's a really good report. And this was in the year 2000, so now, you know, 7 years old. And
there's two reports. There's the president's report, which was the surgeon general's report.
The surgeon general's 2000 right.
Report on mental illness. Then there's the freedom from the commission that you're referring to, the second report.
Okay, the second one. I'm familiar with the first one.
Surgeon general.
The surgeon general. I don't know when I came up with that. Right. I must have had a brain fart. Anyway, I really agree with the stigma, and then I started to become interested in that, to look at what causes stigma. And there were several panels, and it's been something that's been discussed a lot, and of course here we're discussing it today. What I see is, you know, it's a lack of education, and like, I forget the gentleman's name there, Dr. Some
Spectre, Augie.
Dr. Spectre.
Augie, yeah.
Okay.
Augie, I don't need the doc.
Okay, Augie, he mentioned that, you know, he sees hope and that things are improving. I would tend to agree with that. I had read some information where the advent of advertising of pharmaceuticals on TV has also helped with, in some ways it's helped improve, eliminate stigma by creating awareness, but on the other hand, it's actually increased stigma in other areas, that they've done ratings and that there was less stigma in against mental health issues and people with mental health. There was less stigma in the 50s and early 60s than there is today. And that study was, I found curious as to why. And because, you know, you don't want to go around telling people you're taking Zoloft or you're taking Prozac or, you know, in the workplace. And you'll hear very often on television, even on NPR one time, I remember a former girlfriend of mine heard them use schizophrenic in an inappropriate way. And she actually called NPR and they recanted it. And I remember just last week, Katie Couric was doing a report on bipolar disorder in children. And she said the girl was bipolar. Well, the point in our language is somebody really isn't the illness.
Right.
They have bipolar disorder. If you wouldn't say, like Dr. Lippman is cancer or is coronary, you know. And that's what you're schizophrenic. Okay, I just walked in, I believe, probably when you were talking about that. But we define people as being the disease, which is stigmatic in itself. I think one big key thing is educating children and educating the media on how to report on these issues, because they can demonize mental health conditions and play on people's fears. Because if you look at in the movies, you know, they have always the psychotic killers, and people have these images in their mind of people with mental illnesses are out here doing these horrible, horrible, horrific crimes. So there's kind of this latent, almost inborn fear of mental health conditions because people don't understand them. So I think dispelling the fears by education and enlightening people about what they truly are, and by changing our language, rather than mental illness, I generally say a mental health condition. And I don't even really like that. I would even rather prefer by saying a neurological brain disorder, because, you know, get rid of the mental. My mental illness has taken me on quite a journey. I actually spent 3 years, I was institutionalized because I was having an episode. I had just gone into the hospital. I had 4 ECT treatments, electroconvulsive treatments, or I'm sorry, 8 of them. And I don't know if anybody here knows what they're like, but when you've been zapped like that, you really are disoriented. You don't have your memory. I came out. I had drug dealing going on in my home. The police raided my home. I got arrested, went to trial, ended up spending 3 years in prison for something I didn't do. And let me tell you, you don't want to go to prison with a mental health condition like this. I mean, the best thing that the psychiatrists there did was over-medicate me, because I would have been in, you know, I just would have been in tons more trouble. So stigma, you know, I felt a lot of it, you know, being behind bars, being going through the criminal justice system, not having the hospital advocate for me when I was in the hospital when this was going on, not even having the Mental Health Association advocate for me when I was, had called them and they had people there in the ward that saw I was there, saw that I was legitimately sick, having a defense attorney during the trial call my psychiatrist to shrink, which during sentencing I chided him and the room got completely quiet, but I still got 3 years. I mean, it just goes on and on and on and on. But stigma is fear-based, and I think now what's recently happened is there are mental health courts that have kind of come in to play, and I'm not really 100% familiar with how they're working, but this occurred in the late 90s with me myself. So I know about stigma, and it's something that the way newspapers, the last thing I wanted to say is there was a study done on two newspapers about stigma, and it was the Boston Globe and the Boston Times. Are you familiar with that study? I think if you check it online, you can find it. And they show how two different newspapers report on a crime, it was a murder that was involved mental illness, and how one was really tried to describe the mental illness part, the other really took it and, you know, they used these horrific words to describe the killer as, you know, psychotic and things like this that really scared. The other one was trying to downplay it. So we really need to educate the media on how to report these things and get them to open up their eyes and see that mental illnesses are biological in nature. And that's all I have to say. Thanks for listening.
Well, those of you who know my name, that's fine. For those of you who don't, I'm going to be John. Well, first of all, I mean, I think that as far as stigma, I mean, there's a lot of companies out there. I know of a company that they don't, they're a company that deals with people with mental illness. They say they are, but then they don't practice what they preach, and they don't know anything about mental illness at all. And I worked for this company for 2 years, and they didn't know how to address any issues when I was time off work. They gave me a runaround, and it was just like incredible, because they're supposed to be understanding and supportive of people with mental illness, and they had no idea what the scenario of it. And it's just overwhelming that there's companies out there that exist, and they claim they're a company that just works with people that have mental illness, supposedly. But the way I got treated there was just absolutely ridiculous. And I'm surprised that that there's companies out there that run like that and get away with it. But anyway,
in response to that, if I may interject, I had read an article where among mental health professionals, there is a high rate of stigma.
Yeah.
Even among mental health professionals.
And non-mental health professionals.
And
non-mental health doctors. I mean, you know, regular doctors. A lot of stigma.
On that point about the work settings, there's a lot of this. The rhetoric is one thing, the reality is another. Miriam has told me about it. The city of D.C. actually has a job opening for, of all things, an Office of Consumer Affairs for Mental Health. The director of the Office of Consumer Affairs. But government, and Augie could probably address this a lot better, government has a lot to do itself. You know, they have all these mandates to hire people with disabilities they haven't met. The employment rates have not changed, and Larry probably knows this better than even I do. But basically in 30 years, the employment rate hasn't changed much. But just to take this one example, to your point, on this job, I was looking at this job, it's a high-powered, big job, but, you know, you have to fill out the application in the usual, rigid, traditional way. And I called the office up and I asked them because they want to know your last position, salary. And I said, well, what if you've had a fluctuating, you know, what if you haven't had a work? What if you had work that was at the same level but it wasn't paid? And more with the changes in the economy, we're going to be moving into these kind of things. But government somehow always seems to be a couple of decades behind anyway. And you know, here of all offices, it should sort of have a different approach. But no, their approach would be the same as if you're applying for any other job. So there's a lot of tremendous thing. And this work issue is very important. That I think even the people aren't even aware of how important it is beyond that we need to work for our own satisfaction.
Okay.
All right, let me just finish this real quick. If, as I said, the overall statistics for people with disabilities and people with mental illnesses, that's one of the big questions is why, despite all the treatments and laws, it hasn't really changed over 30 years. People on SSI, same percentage of people get on off of SSIs,
as before the ABA, since the ABA and the tickets were all these things. But because of these, the fact that people like myself, I live on $600 a month, $640 a month in Montgomery County, and I live on SSDI, there are these larger economic forces, and one of the biggest ones that no one seems to even talk about is that our measly cost of living actually has a systematic bias such that if you're poor, basically, you're constantly losing ground in terms of your economic, your income is not, your cost of living checks are not really keeping up. It has to do with the cost of the consumer price index has these built-in biases, and one of the biases is depending where you live, but even beyond that, if you're poor. So effectively, people like me are now in a situation where I can't even live, afford to live in this county. So the situation is getting, for a lot of reasons, which I don't have time to go into. There's a massive state budget deficit, massive county deficit. There's a federal budget situation in terms of the funding situation. The things are actually, even though in a lot of ways they're looking up, in a lot of other ways things are getting worse. And if we don't figure out better ways of helping people become, quote, economically empowered, a term that's right out of the Freedom Commission report, in terms of recovery, in terms of getting people work and getting their better, higher incomes and assets, we're going to have a situation within 5 or 10 years, even less than that, because I'm already at that situation now. I have to borrow money from my family, where the average public mental health consumer is unemployed, on disability, living below the poverty level, is not going to even be able to live in this county, or maybe anywhere in the country, because I've been on these programs for a long time. You're actually, in general, worse off all the time than you were here before because of these biases. And so we made some progress, but we have a lot more to do.
I would just like to say, these are great points, and I want the discussion to continue. I just want to point out that as I hear the discussion, it's going along two lines. One line is, what do we need to do to educate, to publicize, to especially educate in the workplace and prevent discrimination in the workplace? And I think Larry and now Randy, too, are mentioning the importance of employment in the workforce. So I think that that's a very powerful point, and I'm sure everyone is going to talk about that. The other thread was also our own identity, or the identity of those that suffer with a mental health disability. Do they emphasize the disability too much? Does society emphasize the disability too much? Is it better to make people have other identities? I'm going back to the teenagers, the point that you made about the teenagers. Get them when they're thinking that they're teens, and get them to think of this like a broken arm, as opposed to what defines them forever. So with that in mind, let's hear more. Let's see how those themes intertwine.
I have something directly related to what you're saying. And I'd like to address both of them, and you'll see how they're combined. The issue of a need to educate the workforce, especially the hiring officials, managers in the workforce, and also identify those who suffer. One of the projects that I've been trying to talk to the state of Maryland about, and I've also tried to start to do this on my own with Chambers of Commerce in Montgomery County, and that is to take a few people who have unseen disabilities, and I have about six people right now who I could use, and go to the Chamber of Commerce and other types of employers here in the county, and have these people talk about their abilities, not their disabilities. They can get up and say, yeah, I have a disability, okay, and this is what it is. That's it, okay? I mean, people understand that. Now the question is, what ability do they have? I'm going to give you an example. On Tuesday, I was downtown, and I met a fellow who's homeless and also has, suffering from some mental issue, disability, and he's selling the newspaper, Street Scene.
Yeah.
Where he gets 75 cents for per dollar of sale. And I've known these people and talked to these people over the last few years. But this fellow was in particularly excellent. I even took a photograph of him. He is homeless. He was wearing a tie and jacket, a suit, which was very unusual for the people selling the newspaper. And he was very literate. He talked extremely intelligently. And he talked very well, his diction, his grammar, etc. So I got into a discussion with him after I paid him my dollar for the newspaper, and found out that he had his own business. The fellow's about 35 years old. He had his own business selling hot dogs on a hot dog stand up in Philadelphia. He didn't make any money. He worked all day and all night. He finally sold the hot dog stand. He came down to Washington, and he worked for a little while until the employer found, similar to Scott, found that he had some kind of a mental issue and was let go in the job. And it was a writing job. He happens to have an editorial in the current issue of Street Scene talking about the fact that there's stigma going on. I talked to him about why doesn't he join my little group and talk to Chambers of Commerce about what his abilities are. He can write, he knows how to work the computer, etc. There's another person that I know who is an extremely talented web designer. And he comes, in fact, to this drop-in center. He's a very talented web designer, etc. But he doesn't seem to have the self-esteem within himself to really look for a decent job. Okay, so what it needs is an education of the fact that he's got, these people have something to contribute to the workplace, very positive. Two, we have to educate the employers, and we can do it through giving programs to chambers of commerce and religious organizations, etc., where there are business people. And three, we have to improve the self-esteem of the very people that are trying to get these jobs. And instead of looking at their dis, look at their plus.
What's the good, best way to do that?
The best way to do that? I think one, I don't know about the best way, but several ways. Let's take the drop-in center here, that the Silver Spring drop-in center that Miriam's the manager of. We have people here who are consumers, and they have mental disabilities of various types, and they're actually beginning to lead some discussion groups. They're planning on doing that. This center, for example, has people who are consumers who are actually running some of the programs or assisting in the program. So what we try to explain to them is this is something that you have an ability to do. You have the ability to do some planning. You have the ability of communicating with people by contacting, et cetera, et cetera. That's what you put on your resume, what you've done. Even if it's in a voluntary situation, even if you're working, you're looking for a job for the government, you put on your resume, you make the resume you want, the way you want to make it, not the way the government wants to make it. Because the government really doesn't care how it's made. You just have to answer their questions. So once you understand how to fill out a resume for the government, you can then put down, well, I was the program manager, okay, I put that in quotes, but I was the program manager of the drop-in center for doing X, Y, and Z, and we've had 50 people come to the event over the last 2 years. I don't know, I'm making up something off the top of my head, but I think you can understand the issue here. The issue here is, what's the ability? Planning, designing, coordinating, blah, blah, blah. These are the words now that the government or any other employer, and there's many books that have these words in them, that they're looking for. Take the right words, take the abilities that you have, put the two together, and maybe the chances will be better. Maybe.
I wanted to touch on what's not being brought up, too, about disabilities. And the Americans with Disability Act was passed into law in 1991. It's now 15 years old. Some courts have watered it down. They write laws, they interpret them, and then they take people to court to challenge or change them. But really, and DC just did last year the Disability Rights Protection Act of 2006, where 70 community groups had to come together to get a bill passed in City Council of Washington, DC. And then I saw an email about they need to strengthen the Americans with Disability Act, the justice, something for justice. But really, what will change is when people's attitudes change, either through education or something, of how disabilities and how those people, you know, they can write laws and keep on writing laws, but until people's attitudes change about people, that will help change the problem of the stigmatization.
I would like to Justice Monskari. I do think that the problem of the stigma in the mental health community is actually part of a bigger problem. It's the problem of how people are trained or educated to accept each other. I remember this story about my son when he was in second grade. He didn't interact at all with the other kids. He was just the black sheep in the class. There was no way he was going to have any kind of interaction. Then one day he got a substitute teacher because his teacher was going to have a baby. This substitute teacher, she turned everything around. I don't know how she did it. She decided that she was not there to teach the kids because anyway, in this area, all kids were very smart. They could learn math and English in their sleep. She was going to teach them how to respect each other. That was, wow. The whole dynamic of the class changed. The Hispanic kid, he was bullied all the time because maybe he was a little fat or maybe he didn't speak that well, but he was the one who did all the errands for his parents, even though he was 8, or I don't know how old he was. So the teacher said, you know, explain to the other kids what was going on with William. And then my son got to read whenever they had to read something because he was a very good reader and he knew what he was reading, so he had, you know, the expressions and everything. He became a star in a few days. It was just unbelievable. And she turned the class upside down. The dynamic had completely changed. When I stepped in this class, I could see that everybody was talking to each other. It was just joy and it was alive. It was night and days compared to the class I was there before. And these kids learn to respect each other.
You know,
if we could teach that to all the kids, we'd solve all the problems that we're talking about.
I just want to say, we talk about educating people in the workplace, but sometimes I think it has to start
at
the level that you're
not
working.
Sometimes.
And I want to follow up on this because I wanted to bring this up anyway because I'm so glad you said it. This is a shift away from the work, but I'm so glad what you just said because it's so important. Because I met Miriam through the Mental Health Advisory Committee, right? Because I was on that advisory committee with this Miriam, and I guess that you got involved because you were trying to find help for your son. And you told me a little bit about how you couldn't get help from the school system, from the mental health system. You tried all kinds of things, okay? But what I wanted, exactly what you're talking about this, because this goes right back to Virginia Tech, what you were saying about what happened in second grade. Because Miriam she had me over for dinner a couple months ago, and I got to meet her son, who I had never met before. She wanted me to meet him. And like you had told me a little bit about his situation, but I sort of forgot because it had been a while, it's been a couple years, and I didn't know the whole story. It was only later, after we had that dinner, that you told me it. So we had this great dinner, you know, it was the three of us, and we were talking, just like we're talking, back and forth. And afterwards, after he left, you remember you told me this afterwards, I think the same after he left, you said something like, you know, I haven't seen him have that kind of interaction and, you know, speak, you know, the talk. You said he had been very withdrawn and for a long time, and even when you had other friends over. So I had been thinking a lot about it. We haven't had a chance to really talk about it. I was hoping to talk more about this. I've been thinking a lot about what happened that night. And if that was true, because you said he was staying home and playing video games instead of going to school, couldn't get him. But what I experienced, I was thinking, what happened? And what I thought happened is, I remember just coming over, and not that I'm anything special, I have no mental health background, but I remember the first thing is, when I first met him, asking him, I was curious about how the cafe scene in Bethesda compares to in France. And I asked you both that. That was like one of the, because I had just been in Bethesda the day before, and I'd never been to Europe, and you guys are from France. And I remember one of the first things, and I just remember somehow, he was, you know, he responded, and we were engaging. And you know how it got, at some point, it was hard to shut him up. He was talking, interrupting you, and at the end of the night, him and I were debating about the politics, and I know a lot of, and he's an incredibly smart kid, you know. I mean, he almost knows as much about politics as I do, and I do it as a hobby. But I guarantee you, he knows more than 99.9% of the kids who did go through high school. And somehow, he's incredible. So I was thinking, what happened? I mean, I'm thinking that he probably, if any mental health professional who's ever seen him or ever would give him a diagnosis, he probably has 20 diagnoses. But when I forgot all about that, what I'm saying is, I saw he was a human being, and I was relating to him as a human being. And I was also open about my own self, which I hadn't been before, before I would have been a kid, I would have admitted I'm unemployed or something. I was home about my theory, right? And I'm thinking, I thought a lot about this, because I know a lot of people who are as isolated as him. People who are from his age up to 80, living in a, I told this at the last meeting, people I know for whatever reason. And I think that when you cut through all the diagnoses, last time people were talking about, was it predictable? This Cho would have done what he did. Of course it's predictable. You don't need a degree to know. It was 100% predictable. When you become essentially that, he wasn't even living a human life anymore. And to remind people, the report, which I'm not sure I even will give out, because we were giving this on the Federal Advisory Committee, but apparently he had not, this guy Cho at Virginia Tech, did not have a single human interaction, period, until the end. And the first real reaction he had is when he reached out to a girl and a police ended up coming after him because it was inappropriate. So what I'm saying is that if we cut through all the, you know, programs and the this and that, what really is needed is, well, I don't have anything. I think it's simply being able to say, see past people that may be a little different, a little eccentric. Because what I was realizing is, oh, he's an interesting person. He's not even, we're different ages and everything. But it's just the level of a very basic human interaction. And I think that even this guy Cho, I don't care how many diagnoses you have, selective mutism, all these fancy terms that experts say they're not even causal explanations, they're just labels. They don't necessarily explain anything. I still think that even this kid, that somebody could have reached out to him, a doormate, a roommate. They said they tried, but they gave up. They interviewed the kids afterwards. They said, well, we talked to him. He didn't respond. He seemed like he was aloof and unfriendly. They didn't try. I know in my heart that there was, even this kid, it was this way, there was a way to reach him. He was a smart kid. He was an engineer. Some way of reaching his interest. Just like something happened that night. All of a sudden, the kid said, how could somebody have all these, doesn't talk, but then he talks as if we're talking like you and I are talking.
No, so how do you put that into action, though? How would you operationalize that?
You could do it a lot of ways. Once you grasp that the underlying thing is, what more than anything else is, we need community, and so people aren't isolated, and you need to build in human interactions. For example, this came up at the last meeting. In a college setting, people have interests, like the kid's show. Okay, he was an engineer. Somebody could have created a thing where, like, a club, okay, once you think about how to do it, but it's also just reaching out and not, I don't know how you educate people to sort of, like, look past somebody who seems a little bit different and see that they might be in a very interesting, fascinating, brilliant person, even, because I'm sensitive to that myself, because I didn't come to a kid like this and say, well, what do you want to do when you grow up? I don't want people asking me with that. How do you inculcate how to treat people as equals, as a human being? That's right. The way you want to be treated yourself. It goes way back to some people who said this thousands of years ago. I think it's really, at some level, that simple.
Well, I guess that's what I mean. How would you inculcate people? What stage of life?
Can I respond to that?
Go ahead.
Okay. Some of the stuff you can do on a very personal level. You know, we've heard about the personal is political, and I think I'm able to do it now more than I ever have, and of course, that may not be the same thing for anyone else with a stigmatized illness, to kind of just make it, kind of drop it here and there, and like, oh yeah, I had a depression, or I was really depressed last week, I had to, you know, whatever, and to make it like not a big deal, because basically you want to desensitize the issue.
You want to normalize the issue. But also, in this case, you don't want to relate to him as, I wasn't relating to him as a person with any disability. I was relating to him in terms of his ability and his interest, just like somebody else was saying.
Exactly.
I sort of forgot about all
the whole point
problems
is to had. The whole point is to also let, kind of get people, if more and more people came out, and unfortunately, sometimes it has to be the, you know, the people like Kay Redfield Jamison, who's highly respected in her field, you know, people that are the super accomplished people to come out and say, guess what, I have an illness and it's psychiatric, you know, and you want it to to trickle down to all sorts of levels, because we all are different and we're not, you know, there's a huge mass of variety in people with mental illness. And so I, you know, some of it is in media, and NAMI does that quite a bit. You know, NAMI's theme for the Heroes Dinner this year is everybody knows somebody, you know, and that's an interesting approach. But I don't know, I want people, other people to bring up ideas too.
I think the great talent that this teacher had is that it's not, I think it's not enough to accept. You also have to have build that interest for the person, and the way to build an interest in the person is that somebody has to show you the ability that
exactly,
this person
to
has.
Hone in
and that's what Mrs. Twinkler, God bless her, did. She was like, see Benji, he can read. Now Benji, sit there and read the story, and Benji reads the story, and everybody is like that. And look at this one, she draws beautiful pictures and look like, and then the kids, not only they accept each other, but they are interested.
It's also like Augie was saying, how many people would have walked by that guy on the street and never realized what this person could do?
Right.
Most people would walk by and say, he looks like a bum. Here it is.
The thing is with homeless
people,
99.9%
of people would have walked by and never even talked to this guy.
Right.
Wherever they walk by, I've seen, I watch people
and
that
got
are
to know the way you
and
did.
How people look at them and they don't help. Or
they,
there's a program, that's somebody else's problem, that's not my problem.
Right.
People
and, and the other thing I wanted to, what we're saying, talking about, is that our system is a reactionary system and not
yeah.
necessarily a proactive. It only reacts to
right.
things that happen.
Right.
And when we're saying that that person in the Virginia Tech tragedy didn't get help, as the maybe it wasn't enough.
Preventive medicine
or
doesn't
when
exist.
When the time was right to for that first time when they started questioning. The systems that communicate and they didn't take a strong enough proactive
no
response.
That doesn't exist. My son was in trouble for such a long time, and I'm thinking, what, we are waiting for him to jump from the window or, you know, do something really bad and then something will happen, you know?
I remember I was in Union Station, I'd say about 2 years ago, maybe it was three, anyway, it doesn't matter, but a young lady came over and asked me for some money, you know, the panhandling, and I said, well, you know, what do you need it for? She said, I wanted to buy something to eat, and I said, okay. So I went over to the food concession there, and I said to the guy, I said, this young lady's hungry, you know, she's going to get some food. When she gets the food, let me know, and I'm going to pay the tab. So she went over and got the food. And she came over, and I said, why don't you sit down and eat with us, you know, because so she sat down. I started talking to her, and I began to realize that she most likely had schizophrenia and that she had been off of her meds. And I came right out and I asked her, I said, how long have you been off your meds? And she said, oh, about 10 days. And so what I did is, then she said she had to go to the bathroom. She started to get a little scared. So we found the security guards and they caught the police, but we got her into a center. You know, they got her somewhere. I told her where she could go to get her meds in D.C. But I knew that she wasn't going to do it because she was going into psychosis and she just wasn't going to do it. But anyway, you know, from my knowledge and having my own illness and understanding that's important, I mean, I cared enough to take the time to do that. The police came in, two police came in and escorted her out. And I'm sure they were very calm. They took her to an ambulance and got her to the hospital. What happened after that, I don't know. I have no idea.
Let me